So I'd love to kind of start out with these wonderful people we meet in the documentary. What was the order of meeting them?
Well, the very first person I met on this film was Debbie Almentazer. And the reason I say first is it was a couple days after the election, and I was pretty devastated by what was happening, and I was invited to a Muslim-Jewish circle, which is like a sharing situation to discuss feelings, what have you. And people were doing that, and then someone got up from the Muslim community and started talking about the things that were happening within her community already, as some of the terrible things that people were confronting. And that was Dr. Debbie, as she is now generally known. And that was very moving to me, and I had no intention of putting her in a film, mostly because she's kind of well-known in activist circles. But she was sort of a resource, and I met with her, and she watched my previous films and was happy to work with me and to refer me to people, as many other people did. Over time, it just became inevitable she'd enter into the film, because so much of the activities in the Yemeni community were centered around her. And it was a sort of organic process of meeting people. I think Dr. Debbie was who referred me to Abir Kawas and to a number of other people. And you're not so much casting to be in a film as much as just going to meet people to learn more. And certain people seem to have a particular angle or presence or identity that would seem to lend itself to a documentary. And you also film with a variety of people who end up not working out for any of a variety of reasons. So it is an organic process, and Dr. Debbie was the very first person in it.
You know, you bring up Abir, and I really was amazed that the one element of the movie that kind of surprised me was the talking about women's exclusion in Islamic faith being culturally based. I think it was the Aman who said that it is definitely the culture that made these laws, not the faith, like in Saudi Arabia where women can't drive. Can you comment on that element? I think that was, it was so fascinating and riveting to see what I think many people use as a negative against Muslim followers is that it's sexist, and yet very much so that isn't a part of the religion itself. It's rather the cultures of the countries that are enforcing those laws, but the people themselves very much don't follow that.
Right. I would never want to be in a position of critiquing or kind of voicing in on another culture. And as I made this film as an outsider, I would be particularly sensitive to that. Yet at the same time, every time I went to a mosque, there were only guys. And in point of fact, when I asked the guys on the stoop in Ozone Park about 20 minutes into the film, after the enormous mass prayer for the end of Ramadan, when there were literally 5,000 to 6,000 people, or maybe more, in this parking lot, and there were all men. And I did say sincerely, where are the women? What's going on? And I said that mostly to kind of give voice to what I knew would be in the minds of my viewers, like, where are the women? And yes, I mean, I knew a fair amount. I knew something about Islam, probably more than most non-Muslims, just because I read a lot, but I didn't really know a whole lot. And I definitely acknowledge that. And it was, what I found really interesting is I asked a number of people about this, number of women. And when I asked Debbie Almentazer, she started saying how these rules were made by men, that it's not at the root of the religion, that women were, and it's true, very, very important at the beginning of the religion, and that these rules were invented by men, and that she understands why they exist, rules being the separation, but she didn't want to be any part of it. And what particularly interested me in that is the previous film I made was about young Jewish women in Poland today who were actually raised Catholic but then found out they were Jewish and were exploring that identity. And one of those women was a young feminist who was within a small Jewish community that was predominantly Orthodox. There were no choices. It was just Orthodox. And she said to me in the film, you know, these rules were invented by men, and I understand why they exist, but I don't want to be any part of it. So when Debbie Almatizer said the same thing to me 6 years later about a different religion and a different culture, I kind of chuckled. I don't mean chuckled as in, like, laughing at the futility, but just at the connection between those two traditional approaches to religion. But more on point, what Shamsi Ali talks about in Saudi Arabia, which is a very front and center view of things, that's not at all representative of Islam in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in the East, which is actually a much larger population. But it's what people in the West tend to regard as what Islam is. And that misconception about inferiority of women is something that comes up a lot. So I'm glad to be able to put a somewhat different spin on it out there for people to think about and consider.
Definitely, and it was a privilege to see it watching the film. Another element that you just touched upon was the many different forms of, many different nationalities of people who follow the Muslim faith. Could you have made this film anywhere outside of New York, where it seems like there is so much diversity? I feel like it was the perfect, you know, we have a Bengali, we have an Algerian, we have an Indonesian, a Palestinian. I mean, it just seems like you might not have been able to make this anywhere but where you were.
That's interesting. I'm not sure I agree with you, but I'm not sure I have the statistics or the demographics to bear it out. Certainly in New Jersey, which is part of Greater New York, so that's not fair to say. It's a very diverse population, but throughout the United States is very diverse. The majority of the highest growing population of Muslim Americans, I'm pretty sure, is Bengali, and is more broadly South Asian, if you include Pakistan as well. And there may not be quite as many pockets, but I do think that, I hesitate to go on the record of this, but I do, and I'm not a sociologist, but I do believe that immigration patterns and where people locate in the States, there are connections of Muslim faith, so that people may end up in Iowa or in St. Louis, and it's not all, say, Egyptian-American. It is people from different backgrounds that have a mosque to kind of center at. So I think it was a convenience of sorts to make the film in New York, because I live here, because I know it, because I know New York, but these communities were new to me, and that was its own attraction. But you're right, there was a critical mass of people and different communities that are relatively easy to get to. But I'm not sure. I know it's a very long-winded answer. I'm not sure it's true that it doesn't exist in other places. I can find that out for you and let you know, but I just don't happen to know. A place like Dearborn, which is probably an even higher, it's definitely a higher concentration of Arab American, not all of whom are Muslim. In fact, most of them are not Muslim, I would assume. Isn't quite that diverse. It is very diverse across the Arab diaspora, but I'm not sure about the other representation. But the last thing I'll say is that African-American, or you can call it American Muslim population, you know, black Americans, that's a very large component of the population as well. Mm. And I did spend time in a couple of mosques that were kind of that orientation. But there was that component of my film having to do with immigration and having to do with first generation to the country Muslims. So I felt that black Muslims didn't really have that experience. So that's why they're not represented more in the film.
Okay. You know, the film is about to screen here this weekend at the Sin Matters Film Festival. And you had your world premiere, I believe, at San Francisco Jewish Film. Can you talk a bit about the film festival cycle, the importance of it, especially in documentary filmmaking?
Well, it's a somewhat changing paradigm, documentary filmmaking. For a long time, the standard for most of us filmmakers, was you got into the best film festivals you could, and then everything moved forward from there. On one level, this is sort of the best of times in that people actually look at documentaries in a way that they didn't in the general population some time ago. You know, they're all over Netflix and people actually watch them and they actually become part of the dialogue, which is amazing. On the other hand, there are so many people making films now due to the access to resources and the fact that technology is relatively inexpensive, that what we end up with as a filmmaker is you're entering a very flooded marketplace. And that's just a reality. So it's hard. And all these festivals, you know, a place like Sundance, which is, of course, the cream of the crop, and that's about to happen. I don't have their numbers, but it used to be something like for 250 selections, they got 10,000 submissions. Those are really hard numbers for anybody to kind of, you know, find success. So festivals are important as a way to get to a kind of broader audience. But I would also say that personally, what I'm really invested in is community events, is outreach, is audience engagement. And in my case, in this film, I have a pretty concerted effort underway to kind of bring different faith communities together, to bring synagogues to mosques for a joint screening and discussion afterwards, and then food and more discussion. I just met today with a diocese here in New York of the Episcopal Church, and they're involved in interfaith work and are really interested in how they could use the film in some of their work. And I have other activities on the outreach front that are working specifically in a more political vein, having to be, being tied to voter registration efforts in various swing states in the upcoming election. So the film festivals are really important. It's great to get those laurels, the festival laurels, on your website, and it gives it a seal of approval. But it's actually a somewhat shifting environment, and it's important when you make films to be really, really resourceful as to how they get out into the world, because there's a lot of different options and paths that are available.
One of the elements of the movie I really love is how open and endearing each individual is. I know with documentary filmmaking, there's a lot of writing that we don't get to see as an audience about you coming up with the questions you want to ask. How did you approach these five people in particular? Were the questions similar? Were the questions different? Was your approach changed per person, or were you able to keep it kind of similar?
There's not a lot of interviewing that goes on in this film. I've made other films, like the film The Return I mentioned that was shot in Poland, or another one called Greensboro, Closer to the Truth, where there were, well, particularly in The Return, because it was filmed over 4 years, I probably shot 10 to 12 interviews with each person over time, and things were changing. And honestly, I cobbled together a lot of what they said from different interviews to make when it wasn't really available. And it was the interviews that drove the storyline. Here, consciously, unconsciously, I'm not sure which, I was committed to kind of spending a lot of time with people and filming them a lot before I would do my one interview. Debbie Almendazar, I only interviewed the one time. And Shamsi Ali and Kobir, I did twice, I believe. But mostly it was a one-time deal after I'd already got a real sense of who they were, and we'd been doing a lot of filming, and I had a critical mass of storytelling under the belt. And I guess my approach to filmmaking is that it's really all about people. And what I'm very invested in is relationships with people. And I am an outsider. I found it very, there were a lot of open doors, you know, just calling people up on the phone and said, can I come out and talk? They said, sure, come on out. We'll meet tomorrow at such and such a time. Almost everyone was welcoming to meet with me, talk with me, not necessarily to film with me, but a lot of people were. And, you know, on a certain level, there's a line in the film where Abir is joking and saying Muslims are a hot topic these days, which is a little bit true. They are. And I actually thought it would be a hotter topic. I actually thought that there'd be many more films on this subject while I was making it. But I'd like to think that what sort of distinguishes what I do is I spend a lot of time on the ground, and I'm a respectful and a politely persistent person. So you're often dealing with people who don't want to squeeze you into their schedule. And I keep showing up. And it's a little easier in New York, where I live, than it is when it involves going back and forth to Poland in that other film. But eventually, you know, a lot of life is showing up. It's just being there and proving that you're there and you care and that you're coming and going. So that's just the way that it developed in terms of speaking to people and interviewing. The charge was just how to gather the storytelling material in interview to help frame what was going on the screen. And it was more or less the same process with each person, but what I might have been going for was different with each one. Someone like Dr. Debbie was a little bit of an expert, even though she's a character, whereas someone like Mohamed Bailly, the young guy in Sunset Park, the Algerian-American running Muslims Giving Back, he was operating a little bit more as a, he wasn't giving me the big picture official expert interview. He was kind of telling his story, which was just riveting, as it were. So everybody comes across in a different way.
Knowing that this film is so top of mind, it's happening right now, is it tough to, I know like the ending of the film, there's not a, like most documentaries, and a chance to kind of catch up. I mean, these things are going on and there's actions going on right now. Do you feel that there's an avenue to extend this story in the future with maybe not extra filming, but extra updates, changes in like you said, the different avenues of showcasing your documentary? Is that fun to know that there is, could very much be, a new life to this story in 6 months, per se?
Mm-hmm. There could be a new life to this story. I'm often asked, with films that are very much people-driven, people will say, oh, you should go back and do a 7-Up or a 14-Up, you know, the Up series. You know, you should go back again now and kind of follow up on where they were. And I always say, I appreciate that somebody does that, but that's just the last thing in the world I'd ever want to do. Because I really love just doing things that are fresh and kind of capturing my own personal first reactions to things. And then I spend a lot of time editing. And even though this was a fast film in its making, because I knew I did want to get it out because it was topical, I still spent, you know, like every day for 2 years working on it. And I don't want to re-enter that space. Not that I'm not happy with that space. I just want to do something different. In terms of updating, say, what's going on now, and right now there's just two lines, what I call the coda of the Muslim ban is still in place, and so is the fight to overturn it. And I'm very sorry to report that the news coming out from the White House that I've been hearing, I mean, not on an insider, just I've been reading about, is that in leading up to the next election, Trump is talking about expanding the Muslim ban to perhaps include more countries or more restrictions because he thinks that'll play well to his base. So, of course, the coda that I would love to have to be able to put onto this film and change it is that the Muslim ban is no longer in place. And I can't really, while there's a lot of effort going on to make that happen, I don't think I can imagine what would bring that about except for a change of presidency. And if that were to happen, I think that the Muslim ban would be removed from effect pretty quickly. So on that level of what is the news, what is the big picture, I would definitely want to be able to update it. On the personal lives of the individuals, it's ironic that Iber, who's 25 years old, she got married after I stopped filming, and I could have gone and filmed the wedding, and I could have, which I would have done only because the wedding meant that she was going to move to South Africa. Mm. She married an American person who's half Muslim, but who's getting his PhD in South Africa, and she decided to go live there with him for a couple of years, and she's now in grad school too. But to me, that was interesting, not so much that she got married, but more that she was living this struggle that she'd been involved with since well before the Muslim ban. But her personal narrative didn't seem to be really be as compelling as like the larger story of the immigration issue in total.
Oh, wow. Well, thanks for that update. I think that's really nice. You know, Adam, I don't want to keep you any longer. I know you're in a time restraint, but I would love to ask, since you are someone who has these subjects hit you and you tackle them with a rigor, is there any chance you can let us know what is down the pipeline or what ideas you hope to touch upon in future docs?
Well, I've come to realize, well, two things. One is what I tend to say is that I'm a monogamous filmmaker. And what I mean by that is, and I stand by that, that is I made this film, I spent 2 years making it, I brought it out into the world, and now I intend to spend at least the next year very much committed to getting it out into the world in a variety of ways, both where it can do good, but when I say do good, I don't necessarily mean just on a political, civic level, but on a human being level of bringing different communities together and allowing them to get to know each other better. And if I don't do that, it doesn't happen. And I don't say that because I'm so important. It's just that I'm the one who's most invested in it. So right now, that's what I'm doing. What I'm also doing is actually editing another film. That's how I make a living, really, is being an editor of documentaries, which I've been doing for a couple of decades now. And it is nice to actually earn a living again, so that's a good thing. But the other thing I've learned is that I don't really look for subjects. Making documentaries is really hard, and I love it. I adore it. And getting to do exactly what I want is something that a lot of my colleagues don't get to do, so I never take that for granted. But as to what I wish to try to jump into and put my energies towards, I'm really selective, because if it's not something that I feel I absolutely have to do, it's basically just not worth the time to do it. It's too difficult. I only want to really sacrifice that for something that I feel I have no choice but to make. And the three independent films I've made, each time the idea, it was just instantaneous. I have to do this. It wasn't a matter of choice. Whatever it takes, I have to kind of try to get this story out there. So I'm always waiting patiently for those aha moments to hit me, for a big bang to say, okay, now this film is going to come into fruition. So some people have like lists and notebooks of ideas of things they want to do. And I do also, but it's not about documentaries. It might be on other levels or not in film. But in terms of film and stories, I just kind of wait for the story to grab me and say, I have to do something about these individuals or this community that's really on the front line of what's going on in America. And that's what turned me on. So there's not another thing that I'm just, that's at my fingertips that I can't wait to turn my attention towards. And I've learned to trust the process that something will come to me and not to rush it. And if I'm really kind of receptive in that way, then I'll have my radar will be up as to what is something that's really worth jumping into. So that's what to expect from me. The answer is I have no idea.
Well, Adam, I wanted to thank you for the three films you have made and taking them to the level you did, because I think it's important that we've been able to witness them. So thank you for that, and thank you for the time. And I hope you get hit with the bug soon so we can see a fourth film.
I very much appreciate that. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Have a good day. Bye.